The greys helped him to sit again, and he lay back a moment. He did not notice that the sun moved a quadrant from the time he lay back to the time he opened his eyes. Curious, he thought, measuring the sun's shadow, not realizing he had slept. I could have sworn it was near dawn. My eyes are playing me tricks. It's nearer the end of the forenoon watch now. That reminded him of Alban Caradoc, and his hands moved over himself once more to make sure he had not dreamed that he was unhurt. Someone touched him, and he looked up. Yabu was peering down at him and speaking.
So sorry, Blackthorn said slowly. Can't hear yet, Yabu-san. Soon all right. Ears hurt. Do you understand?
He saw Yabu nod and frown. Yabu and the doctor talked together, and then with signs, Yabu made Blackthorn understand that he would return soon, and to rest until he did. He left.
Bath, please, and massage, Blackthorn said.
Hans lifted him and took him there. He slept under the soothing fingers, his body wallowing in the ecstasy of warmth and tenderness, and the sweet-smelling oils that were rubbed into his flesh. And all the while, his mind planned. While he slept, Greys came and lifted the litter bed and carried it to the inner quarters of the dungeon. But he did not awaken, drugged with fatigue and by the healing, sleep-filled potion.
He'll be safe now, lady, Ishido said.
From Kiyama? Ochiba asked.
From all Christians.
Ishido motioned to the guards to be very alert, and led the way out of the room to the hallway, thence to a garden basking in the sun.
Is that why the Lady Achiko was killed? Because she was Christian?
Ishido had ordered it in case she was an assassin planted by her grandfather Kiyama to kill Blackthorn.
I've no idea, he said.
They hang together like bees in a swarm. How can anyone believe their religious nonsense?
I don't know, but they'll all be stamped out soon enough.
How, Lord General? How do you do that when so much depends on their goodwill?
Promises, until Torunaga's dead. Then they'll fall on each other. We divide and rule. Isn't that what Torunaga does, what the Lord Taiko did? Kiyama wants the Kanto, ne? For the Kanto, he'll obey. So he's promised it, in a future time. Onoshi? Who knows what that madman wants, except to spit on Torunaga's head and Kiyama's before he dies.
And what if Kiyama finds out about your promise to Onoshi? That all Kiyama lands are his, or that you mean to keep your promise to Zataki, and not to him?
Lies, lady, spread by enemies.
Ishido looked at her.
Onoshi wants Kiyama's head. Kiyama wants the Kanto. So does Zataki.
And you, Lord General? What is it you want?
First the heir safely 15, then safely ruler of the realm. And you and him safe and protected until that time. Nothing more.
Nothing?
No, lady.
Liar,
Ochiba thought. She broke off a fragrant flower and smelled the perfume, and pleased by it, offered it to him.
Lovely, ne?
Yes, lovely,
Ishido said, taking it.
Thank you.
Yotoko-sama's funeral was beautiful. You're to be congratulated, Lord General.
I'm sorry she's dead, Ishido said politely. Her counsel was always valuable.
They strolled a while.
Have they left yet? Kiritsubo-san and the Lady Sazuko and her son?
Ochiba asked.
No, they'll leave tomorrow, after Lady Toda's funeral. Many will leave tomorrow, which is bad.
So sorry, but does it matter? Now that we all agree Torunaga-sama's not coming here?
I think so, but it's not important, not while we hold Osaka Castle. No, lady. We have to be patient, as Kiyama suggested. We wait until the day. Then we march.
Why wait? Can't you march now?
It will take time to gather our hosts.
How many will oppose Torunaga?
300,000 men? At least 3 times Torunaga's number.
And my garrison?
I'll leave 80,000 elite within the walls, another 50 at the passes.
And Zateki?
He'll betray Torunaga. In the end, he'll betray him.
You don't find it curious that Lord Sudara, my sister, and all her children are visiting Takato?
No. Of course Sataki's pretended to make some secret arrangement with his half-brother. But it's only a trick. Nothing more. He will betray him.
He should. He has the same rotten bloodline, she said with distaste. But I would be most upset if anything happened to my sister and her children.
Nothing will, lady, I'm sure.
If Sataki was prepared to assassinate his own mother, nay, you're certain he won't betray you?
No, not in the end. Because he hates Torunaga more than he does me, lady. And he honors you and desires the Kanto above all else.
Ishido smiled at the floor soaring above them.
As long as the castle's ours and the Kanto exists to give away, there's nothing to fear.
This morning I was afraid, she said,
holding a flower to her nose, enjoying the perfume, wanting it to erase the aftertaste of fear that still lingered.
I wanted to rush away, but then I remembered the soothsayer.
Eh? Oh, him. I'd forgotten about him,
Ishido said with grim amusement. This was the soothsayer, the Chinese envoy, who had foretold that the Taiko would die in his bed, leaving a healthy son after him, that Torunaga would die by the sword in middle age, that Ishido would die in old age, the most famous general in the realm, his feet firm in the earth, and that the Lady Ochiba would end her days at Osaka Castle, surrounded by the greatest nobles in the empire.
Yes, Ishido said again. I'd forgotten about him. Torunaga's middle age, ne?
Yes.
Again Ochiba felt the depth of his look, and her loins melted at the thought of a real man on her, in her, surrounding her, taking her, giving her a new life within. This time, an honorable birthing. Not like the last one, when she had wondered in horror what the child would be like and look like.
How foolish you are, Ochiba, she told herself as they walked the shaded, fragrant paths. Put away those silly nightmares. That's all they ever were. You were thinking about a man.
Suddenly Ochiba wished that Torunaga was here beside her, and not Ishido. That Torunaga was master of Osaka Castle and master of the Taiko's treasure, protector of the air and chief general of the armies of the West, and not Ishido.
Then there would be no problems.
Together they would possess the realm, all of it, and now, today, at this moment, she would beckon him to bed or to an inviting glade, and tomorrow or the next day they would marry. And whatever happened in the future, today she would possess and be at peace. Her hand reached out and she pulled a branchlet toward her, breathing the sweet, rich gardenia fragrance.
Put away dreams, Ochiba, she told herself. Be a realist like the Taiko or Torunaga. What are you going to do with the Anjin-san? She asked.
Ishido laughed.
Hold him safe. Let him take the black ship, perhaps, or use him as a threat against Kiyama and Onoshi if need be. They both hate him, ne? Oh, yes. He's a sword at their throats, and at their filthy church.
In the chess game of the heir against Torunaga, how would you judge the Anjin-san's value, Lord General? A pawn? A knight, perhaps?
Ah, lady. In the great game, barely a pawn, Ishido said at once. But in the game of the heir against the Christians, a castle. Easily a castle. Perhaps two.
You don't think the games are interlocked?
Yes, interlocked. But the great game will be settled by daimyo against daimyo, samurai against samurai, and sword against sword. Of course, in both games, you're the queen.
No, Lord General. Please excuse me. Not a queen,
she said, glad that he realized it. Then, to be safe, she changed the subject.
Rumour has it that the Anjin-san and Mariko-san pillowed together.
Yes, yes, I heard that too. You wish to know the truth about it?
Ochiba shook her head.
It would be unthinkable that that had happened.
Ishida was watching her narrowly.
You think there'd be a value in destroying her honour? Now? And along with her, Buntaro-san?
I meant nothing, Lord General. Nothing like that. I was just wondering. Just a woman's foolishness. But it's as Lord Kiyama said this morning. Dark summer's tears. Sad. So sad, nay?
I preferred your poem, lady. I promise you Torunaga's side will have the tears.
As to Buntaro-san, perhaps neither he nor Lord Hiromatsu will fight for Lord Torunaga at the battle.
That's fact?
No, Lord General, not fact, but possible.
But there's something you can do, perhaps?
Nothing, except petition their support for the heir, and all Torunaga's generals, once the battle is committed.
It's committed now. A north-south pincer movement and the final onslaught at Odawara.
Yes, but not actually. Not until army opposes army on the battlefield.
Then she asked,
So sorry, but are you sure it's wise for the heir to lead the armies?
I will lead the armies, but the heir must be present. Then Torunaga cannot win. Even Torunaga will never attack the heir's standard.
Wouldn't it be safer for the heir to stay here? Because of assassins, the Amidas? We can't risk his life. Torunaga has a long arm, eh?
Yes, but not that long, and the heir's personal standard makes our side lawful and Torunaga's unlawful. I know Torunaga. In the end, he'll respect the law. And that alone will put his head on a spike. He's dead, lady. Once he's dead, I will stamp out the Christian church. All of it. Then you and the heir will be safe.
Ochiba looked up at him, an unspoken promise in her eyes.
I will pray for success and your safe return.
His chest tightened. He had waited so long.
Thank you, lady. Thank you,
he said, understanding her.
I will not fail you.
She bowed and turned away.
What impertinence, she was thinking. As if I'd take a peasant to husband. Now, should I really discard Torunaga?
Delacroix was kneeling at prayer in front of the altar in the ruins of the little chapel. Most of the roof was caved in and part of one wall. But the earthquake had not damaged the chancel, and nothing had touched the lovely stained-glass window, or the carved Madonna that was his pride. The afternoon sun was slanting through the broken rafters. Outside, workmen were already shifting rubble from the garden, repairing and talking, and mixed with their chattering, Delacroix could hear the cries of the gulls coming ashore, and he smelled a tang to the breeze, part salt and part smoke, seaweed and mudflats. The scent bore him home to his estate outside Naples, where, mixed with sea smells, would be the perfume of lemons and oranges and warm new breads cooking, and pasta and garlic and the bacio roasting over the coals, and in the great villa, the voices of his mother and brothers and sisters and their children, all happy and jolly and alive, basking in golden sunshine.
Oh, Madonna, let me go home soon,
he prayed.
I've been away too long, from home and from the Vatican. Madonna, take thy burden off me. Forgive me, but I'm sick to death of Japanese and Ishido and killing and raw fish and Torunaga and Kiyama and rice Christians and trying to keep thy church alive. Give me thy strength. And protect us from Spanish bishops. Spaniards do not understand Japan or Japanese. They will destroy what we have begun for thy glory. And forgive thy servant, the Lady Maria, and take her into thy keeping. Watch over.
He heard someone coming into the nave. When he had finished his prayers, he got up and turned around.
"So sorry to interrupt you, Eminence," Father Soldi said. "But you wanted to know at once. There's an express cipher from Father Alvito. From Mishima. The pigeon's just arrived."
"And?"
"He just says he'll see Toranaga today. Last night was impossible because Toranaga was away from Mishima, but he's supposed to return at noon today. The cipher's dated dawn this morning."
Delacroix tried to stifle his disappointment, then looked at the clouds and the weather, seeking reassurance. News of the ninja attack and Mariko's death had been sent off to Alvito at dawn, the same message by two pigeons for safety.
"The news will be there by now," Soldi said.
"Yes, yes, I hope so."
Delacroix led the way out of the chapel, along the cloisters, toward his offices. Soldi, small and bird-like, had to hurry to keep up with the father visitor's great strides.
"There's something else of extreme importance, Eminence," Soldi said. "Our informants report that just after dawn, the regents voted for war."
Delacroix stopped.
"War? It seems they're convinced now Toranaga will never come to Osaka or the Emperor, so they've decided jointly to go against the Kanto."
"No mistake?"
"No, Eminence. It's war. Kiyama has just sent word through Brother Michael, which confirms our other source. Michael's just come back from the castle. The vote was unanimous."
"How soon?"
"The moment they know for certain that the Emperor's not coming here."
"The war will never stop. God have mercy on us. And bless Mariko. At least Kiyama and Onoshi were forewarned of Toranaga's perfidy."
"What about Onoshi, Eminence? What about his perfidy against Kiyama?"
"I've no proof of that, Soldi. It's too far-fetched. I can't believe Onoshi would do that."
"But if he does, Eminence?"
"It's not possible just now. Even if it was planned. Now they need each other."
"Until the demise of Lord Toranaga."
"You don't have to remind me about the enmity of those two, or the lengths they'll go to. God forgive both of them."
He walked on again. Soldi caught up with him.
"Should I send this information to Father Alvito?" "No, not yet. First I have to decide what to do. Toranaga will learn of it soon enough from his own sources. God take this land into his keeping and have mercy on all of us."
Soldi opened the door for the father visitor.
"The only other matter of importance is that the council has formally refused to let us have the Lady Maria's body. She's to have a state funeral tomorrow, and we are not invited."
"That's to be expected. But it's splendid that they want to honor her like that. Send one of our people to fetch part of her ashes. That will be allowed. The ashes will be buried in hallowed ground at Nagasaki."
He straightened a picture automatically and sat behind his desk.
"I'll say a requiem for her here. The full requiem there, with all the pomp and ceremony we can muster when her remains are formally interred. She'll be buried in cathedral grounds as a most blessed daughter of the church. Arrange a plaque, employ the finest artists, calligrapher. Everything must be perfect."
"Yes, Eminence."
"Her blessed courage and self-sacrifice will be an enormous encouragement to our flock. Very important, Soldi."
"And Kiyama's granddaughter, sire? The authorities will let us have her body." "He insisted."
"Good. Then her remains should be sent to Nagasaki at once. I'll consult Kiyama about how important he wishes to make her funeral."
"You will conduct the service, Eminence?"
"Yes, providing it's possible for me to leave here."
"Lord Kiyama would be very pleased with that honor."
"Yes, but we must make sure her service doesn't detract from the Lady Maria's. Maria's is politically very, very important."
"Of course, Eminence. I quite understand."
Delacroix studied his secretary.
"Why don't you trust Onoshi?"
"Sorry, Eminence, Probably it's because he's a leper and petrifies me. I apologize.
Apologize to him, Soldi. He's not to blame for his disease, Delacqua said. We've no proof about the plot.
The other things the lady said were true. Why not this?
We have no proof. It's all surmise.
Yes, surmise.
Delacqua moved the glass decanter, watching the refracting light.
At my prayers, I smelled the orange blossoms and new breads. And oh, how I wanted to go home.
Soldi sighed.
Ah, I dream of a bacchio, Eminence, and of meat's pizzaiola, and a flagon of Lacrima Christi, and... Oh, God forgive me, the hungers of hunger.
Soon we can go home, Eminence. Next year. By next year, everything will be settled here.
Nothing will be settled by next year. This war will hurt us. It will hurt the church and the faithful terribly.
No, Eminence. Kyushu will be Christian whoever wins,
Soldi said confidently, wanting to cheer up his superior.
This island can wait for God's good time. There's more than enough to do in Kyushu, Eminence, isn't there? 3 million souls to convert, 500,000 of the faithful to minister to. Then there's Nagasaki and trade. They must have trade. Ishido and Toranaga will tear themselves to pieces. What does that matter? They're both anti-Christ, pagans, and murderers.
Yes, but unfortunately, what happens in Osaka and Edo controls Kyushu. What to do? What to do?
Delacroix pushed his melancholy away.
What about the Inglés? Where's he now?
Still under guard in the dungeon.
Leave me for a while, old friend. I have to think. I have to decide what to do. Finally, the church is in great danger.
Delacroix looked out the windows into the forecourt. Then he saw Friar Perez approaching. Soldi went to the door to intercept the monk.
No,
the father visitor said.
I'll see him now.
Ah, Eminence, good afternoon,
Friar Perez said, scratching unconsciously.
You wanted to see me?
Yes. Please fetch the letter, Soldi.
I heard your chapel was destroyed,
the monk said.
Damaged? Please sit down.
Delacroix sat in his high-backed chair behind the desk, the monk opposite him.
No one was hurt, thanks be to God. Within a few days, it'll be new again. What about your mission?
Untouched,
the monk said with open satisfaction.
There were fires all around us after the tremors, and many died, but we weren't touched. The eye of God watches over us.
Then he added cryptically,
I hear heathens were murdering heathens in the castle last night.
Yes, one of our most important converts, the Lady Maria, was killed in the melee.
Ah, yes, I got reports too. Kill him, Yoshineka, the Lady Maria said, and started the bloodbath. I heard she even tried to kill a few herself before she committed suicide.
Delacroix flushed.
You don't understand anything about the Japanese after all this time, and you even speak a little of their language.
I understand heresy, stupidity, killing, and political interference, and I speak the pagan tongue very well. I understand a lot about these heathens.
But not about manners.
The word of God requires none. It is the word. Oh, yes. I also understand about idolatry. What do you think of idolatry and harlots, Eminence?
The door opened. Soldi offered Delacroix the Pope's letter, then left them. The father visitor gave the paper to the monk, savoring his victory.
This is from His Holiness. It arrived yesterday by special messenger from Macau.
The monk took the papal order and read it. This commanded, with the formal agreement of the King of Spain, that all priests of all religious orders were, in future, to travel to Japan only via Lisbon, Goa, and Macau, that all were forbidden on pain of immediate excommunication to go from Manila direct to Japan, and that lastly, all priests, other than Jesuits, were to leave Japan at once for Manila, whence they could, if their superiors wished, return to Japan, but only via Lisbon, Goa, and Macau. Friar Perez scrutinized the seal and the signature and the date, reread the order carefully, then laughed derisively and shoved the letter on the desk.
I don't believe it.
That's an order from His Holiness the...
It's another heresy against the brethren of God, against us, or any mendicants who carry the word to the heathen. With this device, we're forbidden Japan forever, because the Portuguese, abetted by certain people, will prevaricate forever and never grant us passage or visas. If this is genuine, it only proves what we've been saying for years. Jesuits can subvert even the Vicar of Christ in Rome.
Delacroix held on to his temper.
You are ordered to leave, or you will be excommunicated.
Jesuit threats are meaningless, Eminence. You don't speak with the tongue of God. You never have. You never will. You're not soldiers of Christ. You serve a Pope, Eminence, a man. You're politicians, men of the earth. Men of the flesh puts with your pagan silks and lands and power and riches and influence. The Lord Jesus Christ came to earth in the guise of a simple man who scratched and went barefoot and stank. I will never leave, nor will my brothers.
Delacroix had never been so angry in his life.
You will leave Japan!
Before God, I won't. But this is the last time I'll come here. If you want me in future, come to our holy mission. Come and minister to the poor and the sick and the unwanted, like Christ did. Wash their feet like Christ did, and save your own soul before it's too late.
You are commanded, on pain of excommunication, to leave Japan at once.
Come now, Eminence. I'm not excommunicated, and never will be. Of course I accept the document, unless it's out of date.
This is dated September the 16th, 1598, almost 2 years ago.
It must be checked. It's far too important to accept at once. And that will take 4 years at least.
Of course it's not out of date.
You're wrong. As God is my judge, I believe it is. In a few weeks, at the most a few months, we'll have an Archbishop of Japan at long last. A Spanish bishop. The letters I have from Manila report the royal warrants expected by every mail.
Impossible. This is Portuguese territory and our province.
It was Portuguese. It was Jesuit. But that's all changed now. With the help of our brothers and divine guidance, the King of Spain has overthrown your general in Rome.
That's nonsense. Lies and rumors. On your immortal soul, obey the commands of the Vicar of Christ.
I will. I will write to him today, I promise you. Meanwhile, expect a Spanish bishop, a Spanish viceroy, and the new captain of the black ship. Also a Spaniard. That's also to be part of the royal warrant. We have friends in high places too, and at long last, they have vanquished the Jesuits, once and for all. Go with God, Eminence.
Friar Perez got up, opened the door, and went away. In the outer office, Soldi watched him leave, then hastily came back into the room. Frightened by Delacroix's color, he hurried to the decanter and poured some brandy.
Eminence?
Delacroix shook his head and continued to stare sightlessly into the distance. For the past year, there had been disquieting news from their delegates to the court of Philip of Spain at Madrid about the growing influence of the enemies of the society.
It's not true, Eminence. Spaniards can't come here. It can't be true.
It can be true. Easily. Too easily.
Delacroix touched the papal order.
This Pope may be dead. Our general dead. Even the King of Spain. Meanwhile...
He got to his feet and stood at his full height.
Meanwhile, we'll prepare for the worst and pray for help, and do the best we can. Send Brother Michael to fetch Kiyama here at once.
Yes, Eminence, But Kiyama's never been here before. Surely it's unlikely he would come now.
Tell Michael to use any words necessary, but he's to bring Kiyama here before sunset. Next, send the war news to Martin at once, to be passed to Toranaga at once. You write the details, but I want to send a private cipher with it. Next, send someone to fetch Ferreira here.
Yes, Eminence. But about Kiyama, surely Michael won't be able...
Tell Michael to order him here, in God's name if necessary. We're soldiers of Christ. We're going to war, to God's war. Hurry up!
Chapter 59.
Anjin-san?
Blackthorn heard his name in his dream. It came from very far away, echoing forever.
Aye,
he answered. Then he heard the name repeated, and a hand touched him. His eyes opened and focused in the half-light of dawn. His consciousness flooded back, and he sat upright. The doctor was again kneeling beside his bed. Kiritsubo and the Lady Ochiba stood nearby, staring down at him. Greys were all around the large room. Oil lanterns flickered warmly. The doctor spoke to him again. The ringing was still in his ears and the voice faint, but there was no mistake now. He could hear once more. Involuntarily, his hands went to his ears, and he pressed them to clear them. At once, pain exploded in his head and set off sparks and colored lights and a violent throbbing.
Sorry, he muttered, waiting for the agony to lessen, willing it to lessen. Sorry, ears hurt, ne? But I hear now. Understand, Dr.-san. Hear now, little. Sorry, what say?
He watched the man's lips to help himself hear.
The Lady Ochiba and Kiritsubo-sama want to know how you are.
Ah.
Blackthorn looked at them. Now he noticed that they were formally dressed. Kiritsubo wore all white, except for a green headscarf. Ochiba's kimono was dark green, without pattern or adornment, her long shawl white gossamer.
Better, thank you,
he said, his soul disquieted by the white.
Yes, better.
Then he saw the quality of the light outside and realized that it was near dawn and not twilight.
Dr.-san, please, I sleep a day and night?
Yes, Anjin-san, a day and a night. Lie back, please.
The doctor took Blackthorn's wrist with his long fingers and pressed them against the pulse, listening with his fingertips to the 9 pulses, 3 on the surface, 3 in the middle, and 3 deep down, as Chinese medicine taught from time immemorial. All in the room waited for the diagnosis. Then the doctor nodded, satisfied.
Everything seems good, Anjin-san. No bad hurt, understand. Much head pain, eh?
He turned and explained in more detail to the Lady Ochiba and Kiritsubo.
Anjin-san, Ochiba said, today Mariko-sama's funeral. You understand funeral?
Yes, lady.
Good. Her funeral's just after dawn. It is your privilege to go if you wish. You understand?
Yes, think so. Yes, please, I go also.
Very well.
Ochiba spoke to the doctor, telling him to look after his patient very carefully. Then, with a polite bow to Kiritsubo and a smile at Blackthorn, she left. Kiri waited till she was gone.
All right, Anjin-san.
Head bad, lady. So sorry.
Please excuse me. I wanted to say thank you. Do you understand?
Duty. Only duty. Fail. Mariko-sama dead, ne?
Kiri bowed to him in homage.
Not fail. Oh, no, not fail. Thank you, Anjin-san, for her and me and for the others. Say more later. Thank you.
Then she, too, went away. Blackthorn took hold of himself and got to his feet. The pain in his head was monstrous, making him want to cry out. He forced his lips into a tight line, his chest aching badly, his stomach churning. In a moment, the nausea passed, but left a filthy taste in his mouth. He eased his feet forward and walked over to the window and held on to the sill, fighting not to retch. He waited, then walked up and down, but this did not take away the pain in his head or the nausea.
"I all right, thank you," he said, and sat again gratefully.
"Here, drink this. Make better. Settle Hara."
The doctor had a benign smile. Blackthorn drank and gagged on the brew that smelled like ancient bird droppings and mildewed kelp mixed with fermenting leaves on a hot summer's day. The taste was worse.
"Drink. Better soon. So sorry."
Blackthorn gagged again, but forced it down.
"Soon better. So sorry."
Women servants came and combed and dressed his hair. A barber shaved him. Hot towels were brought for his hands and face, and he felt much better. But the pain in his head remained. Other servants helped him to dress in the formal kimono and winged overmantle. There was a new short stabbing sword.
"Gift, master. Gift from Kiritsubo-sama,"
a woman servant said. Blackthorn accepted it and stuck it in his belt with his killing sword, the one Toranaga had given him, its half chipped and almost broken, where he had smashed at the bolt. He remembered Mariko standing with her back against the door, then nothing till he was kneeling over her and watching her die. Then nothing until now.
"So sorry. This is the dungeon, eh?"
he said to the captain of Grays.
"Yes, Engine-san."
The captain bowed deferentially, squat like an ape, and just as dangerous.
"Why am I here, please?"
The captain smiled and sucked in his breath politely.
"The Lord General ordered it."
"But why here?"
The samurai said,
"It was the Lord General's orders. Please excuse me, you understand?"
"Yes, thank you," Blackthorn said wearily. When he was finally ready, he felt dreadful. Some char helped him for a while, then sickness swept through him, and he vomited into the bowl a servant held for him, his chest and head pierced with red-hot needles at every spasm.
"So sorry," the doctor said patiently. "Here, please drink."
He drank more of the brew, but it did not help him. By now, dawn was spreading across the sky. Servants beckoned him and helped him to walk out of the large room, his guards going in front, the remainder following. They went down the staircase and out into the forecourt. A palanquin was waiting with more guards. He got into it, thankfully. At an order from his captain of Greys, the porters picked up the shafts, and the guards hovering protectively, they joined the procession of litters and samurai and ladies on foot, winding through the maze, out of the castle. All were dressed in their best. Some of the women wore somber kimonos with white headscarves. Others wore all white, except for a coloured scarf. Blackthorn was aware that he was being watched. He pretended not to notice and tried to keep his back stiff and his face emotionless, and prayed that the sickness would not return to shame him. His pain increased. The cortege wound through the castle strong points, past thousands of samurai drawn up in silent ranks. No one was challenged. No papers demanded. The mourners went through checkpoint after checkpoint, under portcullises and across the five moats, without stopping. Once through the main gate, outside the main fortifications, he noticed his greys become more wary, their eyes watching everyone nearby, keeping close to him, guarding him very carefully. This lessened his anxiety. He had not forgotten that he was a marked man. The procession curled across a clear space, went over a bridge, then took up station in the square beside the riverbank. This space was 300 paces by 500 paces. In the centre was a pit 15 paces square and 5 deep, filled with wood. Over the pit was a high matted roof dressed with white silk, and surrounding it were walls of white linen sheets, hung from bamboos, that pointed exactly east, north, west and south, a small wooden gate in the middle of each wall.
"The gates are for the soul to go through, Anjin-san, in its flight to heaven,"
Mariko had told him at Hakone.
"Let's go for a walk or talk of other things. Happy things."
"Yes, of course. But first, please, may I finish? Because this is a very happy thing. Our funeral is most very important to us, so you should learn about it, Anjin-san. Eh? Please?"
"All right. But why have four gates? Why not just one?"
"The soul must have a choice."
"That's wise.
Oh, we are very wise, ne? Did I tell thee today that I love thee?
She had said.
We are a very wise nation to allow the soul a choice. Most souls choose the south gate, Anjin-san. That's the important one, where there are tables with dried figs and fresh pomegranates and other fruits, radishes and other vegetables, and the sheaves of rice plantlets, if the season is correct. And always a bowl of fresh cooked rice, Anjin-san. That's most important. You see, the soul might want to eat before leaving.
If it's me, put a roast pheasant or...
So sorry, no flesh, not even fish. We're serious about that, Anjin-san. Also on the table, there'll be a small brazier with coals burning nicely, with precious woods and oils in it, to make everything smell sweet.
Blackthorn felt his eyes fill with tears.
I want my funeral to be near dawn,
she had always said so serenely.
I love the dawn most of all, and if it could also be in the autumn.
My poor darling, he thought. You knew all along there'd never be an autumn.
His litter stopped in a place of honour in the front rank, near the centre, and he was close enough to see tears on the water-sprinkled fruits. Everything was there, as she had said. Around were hundreds of palanquins, and the square was packed with 1,000 samurai and their ladies on foot, all silent and motionless. He recognized Ishido, and beside him Ochiba. Neither looked at him. They sat on their sumptuous litters and stared at the white linen walls that rustled in the gentling breeze. Kiyama was on the other side of Ochiba, Sasaki nearby, with Ito. Onoshi's closed litter was also there. All had echelons of guards. Kiyama's samurai wore crosses, and Onoshi's. Blackthorn looked around, seeking Yabu, but he could find him nowhere, nor were there any browns or a friendly face. Now Kiyama was gazing at him stonily, and when he saw the look in the eyes, he was glad for his guards. Nonetheless, he bowed slightly. But Kiyama's gaze never altered, nor was his politeness acknowledged. After a moment, Kiyama looked away, and Blackthorn breathed easier. The sound of drums and bells and metal beating on metal tore the air, discordant, piercing. All eyes went to the main gateway to the castle. Then, out of the moor, came an ornate roofed palanquin, borne by 8 Shinto priests, a high priest sitting on it like a graven Buddha. Other priests beat metal drums before and after this litter, and then came 200 orange-robed Buddhist priests and more white-clad Shinto priests, and then her bier. The bier was rich and roofed, all in white, and she was dressed in white and propped sitting, her head slightly forward, her face made up and hair meticulous. 10 browns were her pallbearers. Before the bier, 2 priestlings strew tiny paper rose petals that the wind took and scattered, signifying that life was as ephemeral as a flower. And after them, 2 priests dragged 2 spears backwards, indicating that she was samurai and duty-strong as the steel blades were strong. After them came 4 priests with unlit torches. Tsuruji, her son, followed next, his face as white as his kimono. Then Kiritsubo and the Lady Sazuko, both in white, their hair loosed but draped in gossamer green. The girl's hair fell below her waist. Kiri's was longer. Then there was a space, and last was the remainder of the Toranaga garrison. Some of the browns were wounded, and many limped. Blackthorn saw only her. She seemed to be in prayer, and there was not a mark on her. He kept himself rigid, knowing what an honor this public ceremony, with Ishido and Ochiba as chief witnesses, was for her. But that did not lighten his misery. For more than an hour, the high priest chanted incantations, and the drums clamored. Then, in a sudden silence, Tsuruji stepped forward and took an unlit torch and went to each of the 4 gates, east, north, west, and south, to make sure they were unobstructed. Blackthorn saw that the boy was trembling, his eyes downcast as he came back to the bier. Then he lifted the white cord attached to it and guided the pallbearers through the south gate. The whole litter was placed carefully on the wood. Another solemn incantation, then Tsuruji touched the oil-soaked torch to the coals of the brazier. It blazed at once. He hesitated, then went back through the south gate alone and cast the torch into the pyre. The oil-impregnated wood caught. Quickly it became a furnace. Soon the flames were 10 feet high. Tsurugi was forced back by the heat. Then he fetched sweet-scented woods and oils and threw them into the fire. The tinder-dry roof exploded. The linen walls caught. Now the whole pit area was a raging pyrogenic mass, swirling, crackling, unquenchable. The roof posts collapsed. A sigh went through the onlookers. Priests came forward and put more wood onto the pyre, and the flames rose farther, the smoke billowing. Now only the 4 small gates remained. Blackthorn saw the heat scorching them. Then they too burst into flames. Then Ishido, the chief witness, got out of his palanquin and walked forward and made the ritual offering of precious wood. He bowed formally and sat again in his litter. At his order, the porters lifted him and he went back to the castle. Ochiba followed him. Others began to leave. Tsurugi bowed to the flames a last time. He turned and walked over to Blackthorn. He stood in front of him and bowed.
"Thank you, Anjin-san," he said.
Then he went away with Kiri and Lady Sezuko.
"All finished, Anjin-san,"
the Captain of Grey said with a grin.
"Kami safe now. We go castle."
"Wait, please."
"So sorry, orders, ne?"
the captain said anxiously, the others guarding closely.
"Please wait."
Careless of their anxiety, Blackthorn got out of the litter, the pain almost blinding him. The samurai spread out, covering him. He walked to the table and picked up some of the small pieces of camphor wood and threw them into the furnace. He could see nothing through the curtain of flames.
"In nomine Patris, et Filii, et Spiritus Sancti,"
he muttered in benediction, and made a small sign of the cross. Then he turned and left the fire. When he awoke, his head was much better, but he felt drained, the dull ache still throbbing behind his temples and across the front of his head.
"How feel, Anjin-san?"
the doctor said, with his toothy smile, the voice still faint.
"Sleep long time."
Blackthorn lifted himself on an elbow and gazed sleepily at the sun's shadows.
"Must be almost 5 o'clock in the afternoon now," he thought. "I've slept better than 6 hours.
"Sleep all day, ne?"
the doctor smiled.
"All yesterday, and night, and most of today. Understand?"
"Understand, yes."
Blackthorn lay back, a sheen of sweat on his skin.
"Good," he thought. "The best thing I could have done. No wonder I feel better."
His bed of soft quilts was screened now on 3 sides, with exquisite movable partitions, their panel paintings landscapes and seascapes, and inlaid with ivory. Sunlight came through windows opposite, and flies swarmed, the room vast and pleasant and quiet. Outside were castle sounds, now mixed with horses trotting past, bridles jingling, their hoofs unshod. The slight breeze bore the aroma of smoke.
"Don't know if I'd want to be burned," he thought. "But wait a minute. Isn't that better than being put in a box and buried, and then the worms?" "Stop it," he ordered himself, feeling himself drifting into a downward spiral. "There's nothing to worry about. Karma is karma, and when you're dead, you're dead, and you never know anything then. And anything's better than drowning, water filling you, your body becoming foul and blotted, the crabs. Stop it!"
"Drink, please."
The doctor gave him more of the foul brew. He gagged but kept it down.
"Cha, please."
The woman servant poured it for him, and he thanked her. She was a moon-faced woman of middle age, slits for eyes, and a fixed, empty smile. After 3 cups, his mouth was bearable.
"Please, Anjin-san, how is?"
"Same. Still distance. Distance, understand? Very distance."
"Understand. Eat, Anjin-san?"
A small tray was set with rice and soup and charcoaled fish. His stomach was queasy, but he remembered that he had hardly eaten for 2 days. So he sat up and forced himself to take some rice, and he drank the fish soup. This settled his stomach, so he ate more and finished it all, using the chopsticks now as extensions of his fingers, without conscious effort.
Thank you. Hungry?
Yes, the doctor said. He put a linen bag of herbs on the low table beside the bed.
Make cha with this, Anjin-san. Once every day until all gone. Understand?
Yes. Thank you.
It has been an honor to serve you.
The old man motioned to the servant, who took away the empty tray, and after another bow followed her, and left by the same inner door. Now Blackthorn was alone. He lay back on the futons, feeling much better.
I was just hungry, he said aloud.
He was wearing only a loincloth. His formal clothes were in a careless pile where he had left them, and this surprised him, though a clean brown kimono was beside his swords. He let himself drift, then suddenly he felt an alien presence. Uneasily he sat up and glanced around. Then he got onto his knees and looked over the screens, and before he knew it, he was standing, his head splitting from the sudden panicked movement, as he saw the tonsured Japanese Jesuit staring at him, kneeling motionlessly beside the main doorway, a crucifix and rosary in his hand.
"Who are you?"
he asked through his pain.
"I'm Brother Michael, Senor."
The coal dark eyes never wavered. Blackthorn moved from the screens and stood over his swords.
"What do you want with me?"
"I was sent to ask how you are," Michael said quietly, in clear though accented Portuguese.
"By whom?"
"By the Lord Kiyama."
Suddenly Blackthorn realized they were totally alone.
"Where are my guards?"
"You don't have any, senor."
"Of course I've guards. I've 20 greys. Where are my greys?"
"There were none here when I arrived, senor."
"So sorry. You were still sleeping then."
Michael motioned gravely outside the door.
"Perhaps you should ask those samurai."
Blackthorn picked up his sword.
"Please get away from the door."
"I'm not armed, Anjin-san."
"Even so, don't come near me. Priests make me nervous."
Obediently, Michael got to his feet and moved away with the same unnerving calm. Outside, two greys lolled against the balustrade of the landing.
"Afternoon,"
Blackthorn said politely, not recognizing either of them. Neither bowed.
"Afternoon, Anjin-san," one replied.
"Please, where are my other guards?"
"All guards taken away Hour of the Hair this morning. Understand Hour of Hair?"
"We're not your guards, Anjin-san. This is our ordinary post."
Blackthorn felt the cold sweat trickling down his back.
"Guards taken away. Who order?"
Both samurai laughed.
The tall one said, "Here, inside the dungeon, Anjin-san, only the Lord General gives orders. Or the Lady Ochiba. How do you feel now?"
"Better, thank you."
The taller samurai called out down the hall. In a few moments, an officer came out of a room with four samurai. He was young and taut. When he saw Blackthorn, his eyes lit up.
"Ah, Anjin-san, how do you feel?"
"Better, thank you.
Please excuse me, but where are my guards?"
"I am ordered to tell you, when you wake up, that you're to go back to your ship. Here's your pass."
The captain took the paper from his sleeve and gave it to him, and pointed contemptuously at Michael.
"This fellow's to be your guide."
Blackthorn tried to get his head working, his brain screeching danger.
"Yes, thank you. But first, please must see Lord Ishido. Very important."
"So sorry. Your orders are to go back to the ship as soon as you wake up. Do you understand?"
"Yes. Please excuse me, but very important I see Lord Ishido. Please tell your captain. Now. Must see Lord Ishido before leave. Very important. So sorry."
The samurai scratched at the pockmarks on his chin.
"I will ask. Please dress."
He strode off importantly to Blackthorn's relief. The four samurai remained. Blackthorn went back and dressed quickly. They watched him. The priest waited in the corridor.
"Be patient," he told himself. "Don't think. And don't worry. It's a mistake. Nothing's changed. You've still the power you always had."
He put both swords in his sash and drank the rest of the cha. Then he saw the pass. The paper was stamped and covered with characters.
There's no mistake about that, he thought, the fresh kimono already sticking to him.
Hey, Anjin-san, one of the samurai said. Here you kill 5 ninja. Very, very good, ne?
So sorry. 2 only. Perhaps 3.
Blackthorn twisted his head from side to side to ease the ache and dizziness.
I heard there were 57 ninja dead. 116 browns. Is that right?
I don't know. So sorry.
The captain came back into the room.
Your orders are to go to your ship, Anjin-san. This priest is your guide.
Yes, thank you. But first, so sorry, must see Lady Ochiba. Very, very important. Please ask your...
The captain spun on Michael and spoke gutturally and very fast.
Ne?
Michael bowed, unperturbed, and turned to Blackthorn.
So sorry, senor. He says his superior is asking his superior. But meanwhile, you are to leave at once and follow me to the galley.
Ima!
The captain added for emphasis. Blackthorn knew he was a dead man. He heard himself say,
Thank you, captain. Where are my guards, please?
You haven't any guards.
Please send my ship. Please fetch my own vassals from...
Order go ship now! Understand, eh?
The words were impolite and very final.
Go ship!
The captain added with a crooked smile, waiting for Blackthorn to bow first. Blackthorn noticed this, and it all became a nightmare. Everything slowed and fogged, and he desperately wanted to empty himself and wipe the sweat off his face and bow. But he was sure that the captain would hardly bow back, perhaps not even politely, and never as an equal. So he would be shamed before all of them. It was clear that he had been betrayed and sold out to the Christian enemy, that Kiyama and Ishido and the priests were part of the betrayal. And for whatever reason, whatever the price, there was nothing now that he could do except wipe off the sweat and bow and leave, and they would be waiting for him. Then Mariko was with him, and he remembered her terror, and all that she had meant, and all that she had done, and all that she had taught him. He forced his hand onto the broken hilt of his sword and set his feet truculently apart, knowing that his fate was decided, his karma fixed, and that if he had to die, he preferred to die now with pride than later.
I'm John Blackthorn, Anjin-san, he said,
his absolute commitment lending him a strange power and perfect rudeness.
General of Lord Toranaga's ship, all ship, samurai and Hatamoto. Who are you?
The captain flushed.
Saigo Masagatsu of Kaga, captain, of Lord Ishido's garrison.
I'm Hatamoto. Are you Hatamoto?
Blackthorn asked, even more rudely, not even acknowledging the name of his opponent, only seeing him with an enormous, unreal clarity. Seeing every pore, every stubbled whisker, every fleck of color in the hostile brown eyes, every hair on the back of the man's hand gripping the sword hilt.
No, not Hatamoto. Are you samurai or ronin?
The last word hissed out, and Blackthorn felt men behind him, but he did not care. He was only watching the captain, waiting for the sudden death-dealing blow that summoned up all harage, all the innermost source of energy, and he ready to return the blow with equal blinding force in a mutual, honorable death, and so defeat his enemy. To his astonishment, he saw the captain's eyes change, and the man shriveled and bowed, low and humble. The man held the bow, leaving himself defenseless.
Please excuse my bad manners. I was ronin, but the Lord General gave me a second chance. Please excuse my bad manners, Anjin-san.
The voice was laced with shame. It was all unreal, and Blackthorn was still ready to strike, expecting to strike, expecting death. And not a conquest. He looked at the other samurai. As one man, they bowed and held the bow with their captain, granting him victory. After a moment, Blackthorn bowed stiffly, but not as an equal. They held their bow until he turned and walked along the corridor, Michael following, out onto the main steps, down the steps into the forecourt. He could feel no pain now. He was filled only with